So our reading this morning comes from the poet Wendell Berry. It's Manifesto, the Mad Farmer's Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord, love the world. Work for nothing, take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance. For what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you've considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your loved ones to the fields. Lie down in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection.
If you get our weekly emails, then you already know that every day this week, when I got home from work, I had at least one package waiting for me on the front steps. Every day, at least one. Not all of them were from Amazon, but most. My partner and I, see, we decided to get a bunch of small little things because we thought they would help us get more organized. It's a dream. New shelves, towel rack, that sort of thing. And we didn't have a lot of money to spend, so getting good deals really mattered. We love free shipping. Plus, with 2 middle schoolers, a clumsy, accident-prone dog, and both of us working in demanding jobs, we don't have a lot of extra time either. So a few clicks, a careful read of the small print to better understand the dimensions, a few more clicks, and done. The packages are on their way. It was perfect. It felt like freedom, even for just a few fleeting moments. Now, all of this clicking was especially ironic this week because in addition to my always awareness of the negative impact that Amazon has often on local economies or small businesses or the environment, over the past couple weeks in preparation for today's service, I've been paying closer attention to the working conditions for Amazon employees. Specifically, the conditions for all those people who were out there somewhere responding to my clicking by finding my item, packing it into a box, and then putting that box in with other boxes to a big box, and then finding those blow up, you know, plastic, supposedly recyclable things, putting them in the spaces, putting it all together, and then shipping it off to me in 2 days or less. Soul sucking is what more than one employee said about their experience fulfilling my clicks. Soul sucking. Now, usually when I hear somebody describe something as soul sucking, I think it must be kind of hyperbolic, but The more that I've reflected on all of this, the more that I've thought maybe it's possible this is an accurate description, that maybe Amazon is literally sucking our souls. So just to start, the work itself is physically demanding. 12-hour shifts where you end up walking 15 to 20 miles with lots of squatting, reaching, lifting. Now, you can get used to this, and it actually is not entirely new or unique for blue-collar work. What is new and uniquely soul-sucking at Amazon comes down to what they call their efficiency standards. The way that they orient everything towards efficiency. Each employee is given a scan gun for every component of their job, which allows everything that they do to be monitored and then timed. And then there's also that allows it to be an alert to be sent to the manager if there's too many minutes off task. Generally, you are allowed 18 minutes off task per shift. Remember I said the shift was like 12 hours, sometimes it's 10 hours, but either way, in the shift, you have 18 minutes where you can be off task. This year, Amazon will likely employ about 300,000 people. That's like just a little under the size of all of Larimer County. Many of us, and many of those 300,000 are working in those warehouses. Not all of them, but the very large majority. Many of us, I think, are familiar with today's economy's crisis of income inequality. As the recent NPR report confirmed, the gap between the richest and the poorest households in the U.S. is the largest that it's been in over 50 years. But Mennonite theologian Mark Baker says that even more pressing and far less attended to, but even more pressing for us as people of faith, is what he describes as our economy's crisis of human dignity. When I first started thinking about the Amazon warehouse, I started to imagine this, the requirements and the ways they focus on efficiency as best, I started to wonder, why doesn't Amazon just use machines to get all of this accomplished? I mean, robots, right? I mean, after all, humans are not actually that efficient naturally, right? In some ways, humanness is inherently inefficient. Bodies, for example, require bothersome things like using the bathroom, which must be fit into those 18 minutes. Bodies require eating, sleeping, resting, all incredibly inefficient. Humans are also required for conversation, connection, emotions, relationship, all very inefficient. One Amazon employee theorized that their assignments were especially designed, like the ways that it would send them back and forth across the warehouse, it was especially designed to ensure that they crossed paths with as few other humans as possible. Indeed, loneliness and isolation is one of the biggest complaints from workers today, not just at Amazon. The younger you are, studies show, the lonelier you are. Nearly 8 in 10 Gen Zers, that's age 18 to 23 or so, and 7 in 10 millennials report being lonely, a sense of that no one really knows them, that they don't have anyone particular to turn to. Only half of boomers say that. The study I read, it actually says nothing about Gen Xers, those of us who are in the literal middle of our working lives, which is typical. Humans are not wired for loneliness. It turns out to have the equivalent health impact of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And even more obvious, humans are not readily oriented towards highly inflexible, repetitive tasks over 12-hour shifts, which, I mean, it is truly efficient. We're not wired for that. Machines or robots or whatever, they have none of these issues. Machines are not hardwired for connection or relationship. Machines don't get lonely, and they are good at inflexible, repetitive tasks over long periods of time. That's basically the whole point of machines. So why doesn't Amazon just use machines? As the artificial intelligence technology and robotics engineering continues to develop, I'm guessing that actually they will someday. And that will be another sort of crisis when it comes. But for now, what I learned was humans, we have a couple advantages over machines still that make us preferable to Amazon and other efficiency-driven work environments. Two, motor control, fine motor control, and subjectivity. So machines aren't yet as good as humans at fine motor skills. And at least for the foreseeable future, which you find out every time you try to ask Siri or Alexa anything of any kind of nuance, humans are better at inference, subtlety, and gut feelings than machines. All of this means that work environments and increasingly our whole culture expect us to perform like our machines, except the couple of areas where we are better. Our work and increasingly our entire culture expect us to conflate efficiency with ultimacy, to conflate a sense of being efficient with being the best. Which means that we have created an economy and increasingly a culture that requires us to suppress our very humanity. We've created an economy and a whole culture that requires us to suppress our humanity or lose our job. Suppress your humanity or struggle to do the basics of life today. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay, want more of everything ready-made. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. Check, 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 check. Now, anyone who has ever worked fast food will tell you there's always been a push to try to get the most done with the least amount of time, energy, resources. Actually, anyone who's ever worked in corporate America will tell you basically the same thing, too. What's new today, though, is just how efficient we believe that we can be, what efficiency can actually mean, because technology has changed our whole expectations, like, exponentially, which is not just because of Amazon. It's also Netflix and Hulu and all the other apps on my smart TV that I love. It's also Grubhub or DoorDash, whatever delivery food service you use, Instacart, or King Super's Pickup, which saves me almost every week. It's messaging apps, or FaceTime, or Spotify, or YouTube, or Stitch Fix, also love. Maybe most of all, it's Google. All of these technologies, these amazing, salvific, liberating technologies have taught us that whatever it is that we need, we can get it now, without much effort, just like click, done. My son recently found this sweatshirt that he was so excited about. And he was like jumping up and down, showing me, pointing me to it. And he even had the money to pay for it. But then it said that it would be delivered in 3 weeks. And he was like, nope. 3 weeks. I mean, there was literally no reason for him to need it sooner. So I tried to explain to him about the Sears robot catalog. Some of you will know what I'm talking about. So, like, you open the catalog, and then in there is an order form that you have to tear out carefully and then fit all of the numbers into the square boxes, make sure you don't mess up, then they might not be able to read it. Then you mail it in, and then you wait for it to come back. And then by the time it gets to you, maybe you've actually grown a little bit, and your mom's like, nope, have to send it back. He would have moved on by the time I explained all that. If something is going to take more than a couple of steps today, and if each of those steps aren't guaranteed to lead towards a successful end, like it's all part of a clear, efficient line, then we just decided, like, basically it's not worth it, not worth our time, which I've come to believe is the business model for health insurance companies. Right? Like, how many times have you tried to fill out those reimbursement forms for something that's, you know, kind of minor, but sure would be nice? So you start to fill it out, and then step after step after step, and you get it turned back. This happened to me last year. Finally, you're just like, fine, I'll just pay for it. Our technologies have taught us that life can be and should be instant, seamless, effortless, continuously available, and responsive to our every impulse. These expectations for life, in turn, become what we expect from each other. Continuously available, responsive, instantly. What we expect from each other and what we expect from ourselves. It's why Mark Baker encourages us to think not only about how we might influence Amazon and companies like it, but also how Amazon is influencing us. Efficiency is our existential purpose. That's a quote from Malcolm Harris. He's talking specifically about millennials and the ways that the generation born between 1981 and 1996 has been, quote, optimized for efficiency their whole lives. Efficiency is our existential purpose, he writes. And we are crafted to be lean, mean production machines. He says this is especially true for millennials and Gen Zers, but it applies to so much of our culture today, to all of us, as efficient has become a synonym for best. And of course, sometimes efficiency is best, right? In the middle of an emergency, I mean, we hope first responders are like obsessed with efficiency. And efficiency is a wonderful antidote to unnecessary bureaucracy. When we set up the Emergency Immigration Fund a couple years ago, we made sure that our system for getting the money to someone in crisis was as efficient as possible. One call, one day, check in hand. And in case my confession at the top didn't make it clear, as writer and activist Courtney Martin says, efficiency is sometimes a survival mechanism. She writes, I simply couldn't care for my children and make a living, and nurture friendships, and contribute to a community in the way that I want to, unless I was extremely judicious with my time and energy. When I read this, I'm like, yes, I bet she orders from King Soopers Pickup too. Growing up, my sisters and I, we were expected to help bring in the groceries from the car when my mom got home. So sometimes, because we didn't like the trips back and forth, we'd try to get as many bags as possible all at once. Now, this was before there were regularly plastic bags, so they're paper. So that means we'd have to like rush to the house before we drop them or they'd fall out the bottom or whatever. So my dad would chastise us saying like, don't take the lazy man load, girls. And we'd sigh and we'd put a few down and be like, okay, we'll make a few more trips back and forth. But later we started to resist his advice with a quick retort. It's not a lazy man's load, Dad. It's an efficient woman's load. He was like, good point. I think we were teenagers when that started. Efficiency can be a way to survive, and it can feel like freedom, even if fleeting. And besides, inefficiency is often a luxury made possible by having enough resources to create margin in your life, time to dawdle or even loiter, as in that great essay from Ross Gay that we read back in November or December. If you can pay someone to clean your house, prepare your meals, tend to your lawn, then you could be quite inefficient in all other things and still manage to accomplish all the basic requirements of being a grown-up today. Inefficiency is a luxury. And at the same time, poverty is also often a recipe for inefficiency. When you don't have reliable transportation, employment, housing, access to the internet, all the stuff that comes with housing, like a washer and dryer, a regular shower, stuff, a place to put your stuff, inefficiency is like destiny. It's one of the traps of poverty that everything that is obvious, easy, and seamless to middle-class folks becomes maddeningly time-consuming and demoralizing when these basics aren't reliable, which makes acquiring the basics like a colossal feat. It helps to explain why when you talk to low-wage workers today, you mostly hear resignation and about all the soul-sucking conditions and gratitude for a steady job. Now, I wonder if any of you remember the book The Jungle, maybe from your high school English classes. I was so impressed. Last service, a lot of people were nodding too. I was like, that's a real throwback. I'm not sure if anybody will remember. It's by Upton Sinclair, written in 1906. It was an expose on the meatpacking industry. It was part of a journalistic reform movement known as the Muckrakers. For about a decade, at the turn of the century, the Muckrakers' investigative reporting led to one systemic change after another, from safety conditions for coal miners to finally addressing child labor laws to election fairness and anti-corruption measures, and yes, of course, reforms for the meat packing industry. I was thinking about The Jungle this week and the Muckrakers because I think sometimes we forget that there is nothing inevitable or mandatory about the world that we live in today. Our economy, our society, our culture, the crisis of human dignity that we find ourselves in, there is nothing inevitable or mandatory about any of this. Despite a pervasive popular pull towards efficiency as our existential purpose today, our faith reminds us that we hold both the agency and the responsibility to create a world that amplifies and celebrates our humanness and our true existential purpose for inefficient interdependence, our relationships, rather than suppresses it. For example, I've been thinking that the most countercultural value that we could promote today would be patience. Patience that is not to be confused with complacency, but rather patience connected to an unwavering commitment to the long-haul faith that we spoke about a couple Sundays ago. To create a world that amplifies and celebrates our humanness would require that we practice and prize a faithful patience, that we become experts in patience, model it, teach it, declare it our good news for a world overly focused on instant success and frictionless ease. Over the past few weeks in this series about the future, I keep envisioning all the people who came before, who worked for a future that they didn't live to see, like James Reeb that we talked about last Sunday, or even Roy Jones, whose sermon we preached two Sundays before, all those whose dreams we inherit. Our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our ancestors, familial and spiritual. This year marks the 100-year anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Maybe you were aware, 1920. So I've been especially tuned in through this series to the stories of the suffragettes, that is, the women who worked to get the vote. As I've been trying to conjure them up in my head and my heart, I've been imagining how much ridicule they must have received, even maybe especially from their husbands. They probably had so many reasons to stop turning up at the White House for protests, for marches, to stop writing letters, to stop speaking up, to stop gathering together in community. I mean, they weren't perfect, especially around issues of race and racism. And still, their willingness to plant trees that they would not live to harvest means that no one here today has ever lived in a time when women couldn't vote. The idea is as unimaginable to us today as it is to my son to wait for 3 weeks for a sweatshirt. So I wonder, what future will we invest in today so that 100 years from now, all those who gather together will take for granted its reality? And I wonder how we will cultivate the patience required for such a commitment, the faith. After all, the future doesn't have to be faster, more automatic, more stimulating, more artificial in all the ways it's been imagined in movies or books. The future could be slow, manual, boring. The future could be connective, personal, playful, real. Every day, we get to decide in the smallest moments, the most private moments, the future that we will create. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Say that your main crop is the forest that you didn't plant and that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that prophet. Prophecy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Wendell Berry's manifesto is brilliant and instructive for this crisis of human dignity that we find ourselves in. But most of all, his last line of the poem, these 2 words that often feel to me like they come out of nowhere, which seems fitting for a poem that urges us to remain unpredictable and wild. He says, "Practice resurrection. In these days, let us remember that it is never too late to begin again. It is never too late to create life anew. It is never too late to forge an entirely new way, to forge a future where all of humanity flourishes freely and together. May it be so, and amen."